There's a Pacific Northwest Labor History Conference this weekend in the University Place Hotel and Conference Center near PSU, which will commemorate the 1919 Seattle General Strike and many other examples of a militant regional past. This conference is open to the public, and a keynote presenter is Lane Windham, who is with me on the phone. She spent 20 years in the labor movement and is now Associate Director of Georgetown University's Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor. And she has an important new book, Knocking on Labor's Door, Union Organizing in the 1970s and the Roots of a New Economic Divide. Welcome to KABU, Lane Windham.
Hi, Lori. I'm really happy to be here with you.
Well, thanks so much for coming on today. The power of unions in workers' lives and in the American political system has declined dramatically since the 1970s. And many have argued that the crisis took root when unions stopped reaching out to workers and workers turned away from unions in this period. But your book tells a different story about many forgotten struggles of the 1970s when millions of workers of color, women, and baby boomers tried to organize workplaces in private and public sectors, including the South, which had had so much difficulty organizing over the decades. Tell us about this forgotten history of 1970s militancy.
Sure, Lori, I'd be happy to. And I'll just say I'm so excited to come to Portland. It's my first visit, and I am excited to be part of the conference.
Great.
Yeah. So, you know, you're exactly right that a lot of times when journalists and historians talk about how working people lost power in this country, how unions have gotten weaker, they point to the pivotal 1970s. And some historians have even said that this decade was, quote, the last days of the working class. And my story is really different. In Knocking on Labor's Door, I talk about this decade as one of really great working class activism and promise when especially women and people of color were leading a whole new wave of union organizing efforts. So really, in Knocking on Labor's Door, the 1970s are the first days of a newly diversified, reshaped, and re-energized working class. I think that many historians and really pundits in general have been blind to the 1970s working class vitality because they've focused on one thin slice of the working class, which was unionized white men. And so they often tell a story of backlash and defeat. But I ask readers to broaden their focus to the women, to the people of color who did not yet have unions but were trying to form them. They had finally gained new access to the nation's best jobs and to the nation's unions following the 1964 Civil Rights Act. And as they poured into workplaces in the 1970s, they demanded unions because they didn't just want a job. They wanted a good job, and so they tried to organize.
And they're using these new legal tools provided by the Civil Rights Act of 1964, as well as some of the older traditional methods of labor organizing.
Well, that's right. They are using the National Labor Relations Act, so they're voting in labor board elections, but they are also gaining momentum from the Civil Rights Act. They are coming into the workforce in a new way, and in some cases, they're also using the new tools that they won under civil rights law in order to make sure that they have more power on the job. So a good example is the organization 9to5, which was based out of Boston. This is a group of women office clericals who formed first an association. They didn't form a union at first. They formed an association in order to gain more power, and they filed many suits through civil rights law. And then they also formed a union, SEIU, what was first local 9to5. It later became district 9to5, and began to organize both in the public and private sector using that organization. So there's lots of activity if we agree that we need to look at a broad swath of workers, not just a narrow slice.
So that SEIU local, of course, and many others like it are organizing new public sector workers who include many women and workers of color. And an important point in your book is that this declining union density that many people have pointed to beginning in the 70s does not erase the breadth of union organizing.
That's exactly right. You know, a lot of times what the experts count when they talk about the decline, they point to the decline in union density, which is the percentage of the workforce that has a union, or they point out that workers were beginning to lose more union elections than they won. And we can talk about why that was. But what I did in this book is I did something different. I didn't just look at the workers who won a union. I looked at all the workers who are trying to form unions, who are voting in National Labor Relations Board elections, whether they won or not. And what you can see by doing that is that 500,000 workers a year were trying to form unions throughout the 1950s, the 1960s, the 1970s. It doesn't drop until about 1982-83. So there's definitely a continued push in the 70s, and it's a far more diversified group that's trying to form a union in these years.
Well, we want to talk about some of those mechanisms that are enacted in the 1980s that begin to stymie worker activism and increase those defeats. But why is it important to look at defeats as well as victories?
Well, I think it's important to recognize that working people, a lot of times when we're talking about how workers lost power or how unions got so weak, there's an assumption that working people didn't try, that working people didn't fight. In fact, there was a massive class-based battle throughout the 1970s, and working people fought really hard and lost. And fighting and losing is a very different thing than not fighting at all. What we learn from studying their struggles is that they were fighting with what were increasingly weak tools, because workers had to face increased employer resistance to union organizing starting in the 1970s. While employers had never been thrilled about unions, they began to dramatically increase their resistance in the 70s. They began breaking the law far more often, bending and breaking the law. They began hiring far more union busters, who, by the way, used the fact that there were more women and people of color to stir up fear among employers to get them to hire them, to tell them how to keep these folks from trying to form unions. And so what you see is that while fewer people are trying to organize by the early 1980s, it is only after a decade or longer of this incredibly vicious attack against union organizing by employers that workers begin to pull back. It's not something that just happens in the 80s. They've been under sort of attack for a decade.
And what explains the rise of this employer resistance, and what kinds of tools do they have at their disposal? I mean, you just mentioned they're breaking the laws, breaking labor laws, but what else helps them quash worker organizing?
Right. In the 1970s, employers do three things to increase their resistance. They become far more willing to bend and break the law. Basically, the law is so weak that they realize they can bend it and break it, and there's no penalty, really. And the law breaking is effective. While workers won roughly 80% of their union elections in the 1940s, by the late 1970s, they were winning less than half. The second thing that happens is even unionized employers at the core of the economy, companies like GM, U.S. Steel, Goodrich, that had long been union, they began to viciously fight workers' efforts to unionize in other places that were not yet union. This is new, that you have these unionized employers fighting so hard. And the third thing, of course, that they do is to rely more heavily on union busters, who many of them received their training in the nation's universities that began to teach that good business practices involved resisting union organizing. And so you ask why employers decided to fight back in the 70s. I think we have to talk about what's happening in the economy, which is by the late 60s, early 70s, employers are facing a newly globalized, financialized economy, and they begin to realize that it's far easier to attack unions, to attack union organizing efforts, than to try to take on the whole global economy. And so they begin to squeeze labor costs, and they do it in lots of ways. They begin to move towards temp workers, they begin to move towards contract labor, all of which we're more familiar with today. This is when it begins. And as part of that, they make this vicious effort to attack unions and to close the door on union organizing.
This is Lori Mercier. I'm speaking with Lane Wyndham, author of Knocking on Labor's Door, Union Organizing in the 1970s and the Roots of a New Economic Divide. She will be here on Saturday at the Pacific Northwest Labor History Conference. And Lane, I really like the metaphor you use in the book, Knocking on Labor's Door. What does that metaphor say about this enthusiasm for union organizing and yet the resistance, or maybe if not resistance, the inability of the broader labor movement to really welcome and recognize this kind of energy?
Right. So what I talk about in the book is that you do have all these workers who had long not been part of the nation's labor movement, who are knocking on the door, who want to come in. And I conclude in my research that the union movement's record on opening the door to them is mixed. In some cases, there is more organizing than experts had realized. Workers are organizing through the steel workers, through auto workers, the textile workers, through the UFCW, and those unions are out there organizing and helping bring many of these workers in. However, the workers still faced lots of racism, lots of sexism on the part of the unions. You know, for instance, there was one woman who was active in her graphic communications workers union. She was worked at a print shop, and she wanted to become a union organizer, and the person who led her local just laughed at her and said, "Women can't be organizers." Certainly, women and people of color being in staff positions, being in elected positions. And there are definitely times when the groups of workers who wanted to organize had to make their demands and sort of push their way in, too.
Well, I think most people know the story of labor's decline and certainly the rise of income inequality beginning in the 1980s. But how does recounting this story of the 1970s help us think about not only current debates about labor's future today, but really can inspire us to think about new ways of mobilizing and new ways of challenging employer power?
Well, I think that, you know, once we realize that working people fought back, they pushed really hard, they tried to form unions, they tried to, you know, make sure that they had power in an increasingly more precarious workplace, this is the shifts that are beginning to happen. Once we understand that working people were fighting, then we have to say, okay, the tools that they were using, which is the labor law, really, from the 1935 Wagner Act, that this is no longer basically a viable tool. They're not going to be able to win using that. So then we have to really think about how to build worker power in an economy that, like today, has far more precarious jobs, lots of people are working on contract, very few people will ever get the kinds of fair wages and full benefits that many union workers fought for. So in that case, do we have to start to think about the role of unions and the role of collective bargaining really is kind of bigger than that which was prescribed by the 1935 Wagner Act? Perhaps we have to think about collective bargaining as something that can bring lots of workers in, whether they have gone through this very narrow door into unions, right? Because it's such a narrow door. Employers have narrowed it down so much. Maybe we have to think about ways to lift wages, lift benefits, to lift social welfare outside the narrow confines of a union and one employer-based collective bargaining agreement.
So then those social security measures then provide people the opportunity to spend more time organizing and expand their power in the workplace.
That's right. That's right. Because, as you know, working people today are holding down two or three jobs and nobody has time to do much of anything.
Right.
True.
Well, thank you so much, Lane Wyndham, for joining us on the Old Mole Variety Hour. And folks can hear Lane Wyndham speak this weekend on Saturday at the Pacific Northwest Labor History Conference. Look forward to seeing you, Lane.
Thanks, Lori.
Started with a protest in the Gilded Age. Chicago, Illinois was the stage. Workers had gathered across the country to demand a living wage. First in Chicago, then in Milwaukee, the state of U.S. democracy was shown to the world with volleys of bullets from the police authorities. Word spread about what happened there across the country from Haymarket Square. Word spread across the oceans to just about everywhere that there'd now be a day when simultaneously on every continent in every country all the workers would march together for the world that shall be.